Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, and good morning.
I called you this week because I think I had told you that I was glued to my computer watching footage of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Could you imagine? I was looking in at some of the encounters he had with world leaders. I'm sure you met him and discussed important things with him. And Uri Savir, I mentioned to you, was one of the people I saw him speaking to about the whole peace process. It was fascinating. And then I saw him speaking to the current prime minister, obviously, you know, many, many years ago. And then I discovered online a video with a gentleman named Benjamin Netai. You know who Benjamin Netai is?
Absolutely.
I didn't know that the prime minister at one time, either he or his father, considered actually permanently changing their name to make it shorter and easier for people in this country. I never knew that.
I think because Netanyahu sounded too Jewish, Netai was better.
Nah, I don't know if that was the reason. I think they just wanted to make
it easier. No, I'm kidding. I don't want anybody to take it seriously. But it, Netanyahu, for Americans, I know even many Jewish leaders
sure.
still don't get it completely straight.
Oh, yeah, if he wasn't this well-known, they'd never get it straight. And I want to tell you something. You've probably seen the video at this point. He's 28 years old, a student. He's fighting the case for Israel against the Palestinian state. It is unbelievable to me how publicly he has maintained. And I know that people will argue with this because of different agreements he has reached over the years. But essentially, he has maintained such a consistent policy, at least in the way he speaks outside of Israel, when it comes to these issues. And it was fascinating to me. I mean, you could watch a video of someone like him, and you could say this about Abba Eben and other people as well, and you know, listen to it 50 years later. It's all the same issues. It's all the same reactions. It's all the same analysis.
Well, there are two points I want to make. One is I just want to confirm that we never talk during the week. And unfortunately, you will never give me a hint about what you're going to ask about.
Including this.
It's completely unrehearsed and unexpected, whatever you happen to come up with. Second, what I think was remarkable about his appearance, and then I saw a similar thing which Mayor Weingarten sent and used on your show, which I don't know if people watched the whole thing, of Abba Eben with Mike Wallace
right.
on the 10th anniversary of Israel. And what's remarkable about both of those things, take decades ago, is how similar the arguments are today. The same issues still come up. It's not as if technology and all the advances and the changes in the world, the same charges against Israel virtually. And, you know, slight changes in demography and demographics, but fundamentally, the questions that Abba Eben answered so incredibly, and Netanyahu, and I've seen the pictures of him in that debate, the film of that debate,
right.
where he demolishes the opposition, but it's the substance remains as relevant and as necessary today as it was then.
It's unbelievable. And people complain that sometimes you and I discuss the same issues week after week. This is decades after decades. I mean, come on.
It really,
it is remarkable. Exactly. It really is not. It's just incredible. People love when we start with good news, and there's a lot of different types of news this week, and we'll try to get to everything, although that's usually impossible. But on the good news angle, and I know it's only a silver lining, believe me, I we're beginning to understand the scope of this tragedy. But from the good news in regard to Israel's angle, could you explain the role that Israel, the IDF, rescue teams have had in the aftermath of this insurmountable tragedy in the Philippines?
Well, early this morning, Israeli doctors delivered a baby boy in the Philippines after they set up a field hospital just hours before. Two big jumbo jets flew from Israel with almost 250 doctors, nurses, all sorts of paramedics, and equipment to a place called BOGO, B-O-G-O, where they set up this field hospital, as they did in Haiti. I don't think you saw any from Saudi Arabia, the Gulf, and all the other countries, as China gave, I think, initial contribution of $200,000 or $400,000, and because they were embarrassed, they increased it to $1.4 or $5 million. You don't see the kind of response. And Israel quietly moved quickly to provide these resources with search and rescue teams, helping to go through the buildings and the appreciation for it, of course, is very great. This is operative already, and this island where it is had a complete power failure, so they have to power their own field hospital themselves.
Wow.
It's really amazing. But they landed Thursday, and by Friday morning, they already saved the baby's life.
I guess that was the baby who was named Israel, right? I read that somewhere, which happened in Haiti as well.
That's right. Running around with names that people will question.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, and the efficiency is unbelievable. I mean, I know that Israel's prepared for everything at every moment, but, and I know this was not at a moment's notice, but it seems like it when you have a scope of a tragedy like this. I mean, their setup, when you mentioned 200 or 250 personnel, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of people who are leaving family, business, their usual work to go and volunteer like this, and obviously in a devastated area. I hope people understand and appreciate what's going on. And you say other countries, you named some of the countries that did not participate in these rescue efforts. It's so important to make that point and to remind everybody that Israel's ready to jump in at any point. And by the way, if the country was an enemy of Israel, they would have offered the help as well. Wasn't there an Iranian earthquake where Israel offered help?
Absolutely. And if you remember, after the tsunami and after other earthquakes where the governments were saying we're not taking aid from Israel Muslim countries, and behind it you see an El Al plane landing loaded with goods, and here these special circumstances, because the IDF, unfortunately by virtue of the experiences and the need and necessities of Israel's security and the situation, has this capacity, and they will be there for a couple of weeks. So think of that, 14 days times 250 people. And also you had people like Zaka and other specialized people with specialized skills after a calamity to go through the buildings and to go into other areas. But I know there were pictures of them, the planes landing in Manila and carrying the equipment for the field hospital, as well as the teams that were working in other areas.
Unbelievable. Sources report that the Prime Minister Netanyahu and Secretary of State Kerry have had several heated arguments behind closed doors about the course of America's Middle East foreign policy as it relates to Iran, the peace process with the PA, Hezbollah, Syria, Hamas, etc. I don't know how important it is that these two men get along. You can comment on that if you wish. But in reality, what is happening? Could you explain to us what the Netanyahu-Kerry relationship is like right now?
It's not just Netanyahu and Kerry. There were also conversations with the president, numerous phone calls. There's also the overall question, not just of Israel's relationship, but first you got to look at what's happening on Iran, and then how Israel fits into it. Some of the other countries, like Saudi Arabia, look at the Russians moving into the region, look at some of the other things which we anticipated and discussed many weeks ago about as one of the likely outcomes of what has been happening and how people perceive the United States and its relevance in the Middle East today. So the P5 plus one had a meeting in Geneva. They agree finally on a plan, which the French endorsed. The French differences, I think, were relatively minor. There are people who speculate that Saudi Arabia is investing a lot of money in France in the agricultural sector and also in arms deals, and that might have been a factor in Fabius, the foreign minister of France's public rebuke of the deal, and then just within a few hours he signed on to it. The content of the deal till now has remained secret, and many members of Congress, especially the Senate yesterday, were very angry because when Secretary Kerry came there, he did not reveal the details.
And encouraged Congress to stick by these sanctions, right? They encouraged Congress to support him in this effort to limit the sanctions.
This is the next phase. We'll come to that in a minute, because you have to understand the totality of where we are. We have sanctions imposed by the Congress and the administration, which is what brought Iran to the table. The debate, the secretary says, don't do anything now. We have a deal on the table,
right,
till Iran, and Iran walked away from the deal so far. and they're supposed to reconvene November 20th. Give us a couple weeks, give us a month, give us 6 weeks till the end of the year, see if we can do it. If you introduce new sanctions, the Iranians will walk away, use that as cover excuse to walk away. Congress says, listen, what got them to the table was the sanctions. We're giving you additional armament by saying here there are going to be more sanctions coming down on you.
Right.
In fact, the deal calls for relaxation of sanctions. Some say, the administration says, it's less than double digits. The Israelis say it's $40 billion impact on Iran, meaning to Iran's benefit. Administration says, listen, in the 6 months of negotiations, they'll lose more money than the benefit. There'll be more money frozen. They say that there's no increase in, so on the financial level, that's a benefit. And the fear is that once you start eroding the sanctions regime, Russia, China, others will look to exploit it, and Europeans who will want to get in and not be left behind, and the thought that if the sanctions regime comes down or is significantly relaxed,
mm-hmm.
that others will benefit and they won't. So everybody wants to be in the first line.
But one of your points is that I have to be careful when I say limiting sanctions, because neither I nor Congress knows if that's what's really in the deal. Nobody really knows what's in it.
I can say it's in the deal. I was in Washington this week. I met the top officials. I heard it myself, so I'm not giving secondhand information. I won't say with whom, but a very high level. And so that on the one side is what they get. They get relief on sanctions, mostly in regard to their ability to trade gold and release of funds that was frozen, that were frozen, part of the funds that were frozen under the sanctions in various countries. On the practical side, I mean, in terms of the program itself, they would be able to continue the process of enrichment, which is something Israel and others object to, saying that there has to be a total stop. They're saying that under the deal, essentially, from what we know, it would be able to go at 5%, but they wouldn't add to the stockpile whatever new enriched uranium. They would have to take away some of the existing stockpile, convert it to gas or other things. The 20% would all be converted into an oxide to gas and or rods, fuel rods, which can be used in reactors, but they say would be harder to convert, although you can reverse the process for a nuclear weapon. All of the existing facilities remain. Nothing gets dismantled. The Arak facility, where the plutonium plant, the heavy water plant, they're allowed to continue construction outside, but they're not allowed to do anything inside. In other words, to complete. We know that there are a lot of technical problems at the plant, at Iraq, so it's not a big sacrifice on their part. So the bottom line is that they could use this time to work on the weaponization. They can work on the missile delivery system. They have the capacity to develop enough enriched uranium in during the course of this six-month period that is supposed to be negotiated under the deal, enough for another bomb. And so therefore, they're saying we get a relaxation for what? What is it, the price that the Iranians are paying? And even from that, they still walked away, didn't sign. They may yet come back and sign and put everybody to the test. The Saudis, the Gulf, everybody, Jordan, others, very upset about it. And we see that Russia moving in, signing a deal now with Egypt, selling them very advanced weapons, air defense systems, new MiG-29s. 48% of the Egyptian military is still based on their old Russian purchases. So those who argue, including things that we have discussed here, that they can't reabsorb Russian equipment, it's not true. They can reabsorb it. They still were flying MiG-21s. More importantly to me is that the Russians get a port at Alexandria. And I know this is a lot of details, but just give me another minute, because all of these things are really important in terms of what it is and why is Israel so strongly against this deal, because we know from history they were tested before. They publicly acknowledge, and Rouhani leading the pack, that he lies, he dissembled, he wrote a book about it, he was the negotiator. We know who they are. We know how they operate, and that the internal pressures, they say we have to worry, you know, they have their own constituencies. They have a constituency of one, and that's Khamenei. And what he says makes the difference. That's the policy that will be pursued. One of the Canadian papers had an editorial and said, we pay, they promise. And that really sums it up, that I think the administration tried to get the best deal and to keep the coalition together. They say that new sanctions begins a march to war. The other side says without sanctions, we're going to have a march to war, because any of the concessions, all of this, will ultimately lead not only to a huge arms race in the region, but to Iran being able to reach the breakout point. And as Senator Corker pointed out, the sanctions don't take place for another 3 to 6 months. The meeting yesterday between the senators and Kerry was quite acrimonious, and a lot of anger because of the sense that they weren't forthcoming, and the differences over the assessments. And all of the experts, guys like David Albright, Ali Heinen, and both former inspectors, one with the who worked for the International Atomic Energy Agency, if you look at their estimates, they say that the low enriched uranium, of which they have 7 metric tons, is 60% of the way. And once you enrich to 3% or 3.5% or 5%, you can break away no matter what. You don't need, with the new centrifuges they have, even though they're supposed to stop spinning the new ones, nothing is dismantled. None of the enterprises where these things are being built is dismantled. And I think that the refusal of Khamenei to see the head of the IAEA, and even though they're signing an agreement, really tells the story that this is Iran buying time, that this is not the basis for the kind of result that people want to see, both those in the region and outside the region.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Then who are these international inspectors, according to this morning's New York Times, who said that for the first time in years they saw evidence that the Iranians have put the brakes on their nuclear expansion?
Well, this is a discussion that's underway about whether in the last few months they have scaled down.
But you just told us a second ago that the IAEA said that they had not scaled down.
So the IAEA, in fact, has been giving reports for the last few years since it was taken away from El-Baradei and Amano of Japan became the head of it, that they've been telling the truth. Amano said, in fact, that the enrichment activities are ongoing. No radical change has been reported to him. That's his exact words. And they was asked whether Iran was continuing the higher-grade enrichment work, and Amano said that's right. Now, this is the head of the IAEA. They were not given access to the Parchin military base, where we believe that the nuclear tests, explosive tests, were taking place. They were not given access to many of the other facilities. They were given access to one uranium mine and to the plutonium plant, but only on planned visits, meaning that you can't make a surprise visit. So we know what they will do right before the visit takes place. So by the way, the agency also reported a slight increase in uranium enrichment. They said that especially about the 20% grew by about 10 kilograms since August. What they're saying is others said that since Rouhani, the production was slower. It could be because of cost. It could be because of technical difficulties, not because there's a policy to slow down.
Well, then it's an argument between you and the authors of this article.
I'm quoting to you directly the head of the IAEA that is supposedly responsible for what you just quoted.
The slowdown, according to diplomats familiar with the Iranian work, was clearly political, not driven by technical problems. But it was also, and I guess this is really the biggest point here, it was also easily reversible, suggesting that Iran was waiting to see what kind of relief from sanctions it could obtain from the West in the negotiations. It's almost laughable that an article that analyzes whether Iran is or is not putting the brakes on their nuclear expansion, a paragraph or two later, is analyzing it the way we are, that relief from the sanctions could be obtained from the West in these negotiations, and that's the only reason that Iran is going through this whole show.
And also, Netanyahu addressed this, and he said that the reason that the report really is based on, that there wasn't a further expansion. It wasn't the maintenance of the existing facilities. It wasn't as if they closed down a facility. They were talking about the fact that all along they've been investing fortunes into this, billions and billions of dollars, and that this, the slowdown in the expansion of its nuclear capacity, but that they have more than enough now to produce all that they need. And the issue we're talking about is, will they roll it back? Will they dismantle the stuff? Will they limit the capacity? We hope no enrichment. We believe that that's the only way you can safeguard. That's what this five Security Council resolutions call for. The Secretary says that there will be fail-safe conditions and that the U.S. interests will guarantee that Iran will not have a nuclear weapon, and the President continues to say it.
Right.
But we just don't know. We know what the history of Iran is, that they lie.
So this agreement that we really would not like to see formalized, quite obviously, if not for France, would it have been signed already? Would there have been a ceremony in Geneva if not for that opposition?
Well, in my discussions with U.S. officials about it, they say that that was grandstanding, that that was not true, and France has signed on to the deal, and that the changes that France wanted were relatively minor. And as I said, some people believe that they were playing to the Saudis. Some people say that, you know, it was...
So if they reconvene on the 20th, are we going to inevitably have some type of agreement here? I mean,
no,
I know
there is an agreement.
No, but it's not, it has not been formalized, no?
Yes. The P5 plus one put an agreement on the table, and now it's up to Iran to...
That's what I mean. I'm saying, will there be an agreement on Iran's side in a formal ceremony, you know, basically, you know, setting it in stone, making it an official agreement?
The Iranians are totally unpredictable. They're saying they want the right to enrich to be enshrined. There is no right to enrich. The U.S. has told us and repeatedly that they will not put anything about the right to enrich. The fact that they allow them to continue at 5% does essentially recognize their right to enrich or their enrichment process, even if we don't explicitly say so. I would say that... you know, what the sanctions in the package do is to reduce their capacity and the ability right now, but it's not any kind of a guarantee yet for the future.
Does it change?
That's what the negotiations. This is a first stage.
Right.
Remember, this is not the agreement. This is only a first stage agreement to enter the real negotiations.
Does it change anything on the ground? In other words, if there would be a formal agreement and Iran would agree, does it put them under any more international political pressure to behave?
Well, again, remember that the details have not been released, but I was told by, again, a high-ranking official that it does require regular, even daily inspections of some facilities. The question is, will they let them see all the facilities? It does require them to stop the enrichment of the 20%, but again, as I told you, with the new equipment, it's far less significant. It does say, supposedly, that the stockpiles can't be raised so that they would have to convert even the 5% that goes beyond what the current stockpile, which is huge and more than enough for what they need. And as I said, they couldn't continue construction of the plutonium plant, the inside construction of the facility.
Who is Russia's most important allies now in the Middle East? Is it Syria and Egypt? Are they their two most important ones at the moment?
Who's the
Russian most important allies of Russia right now? The most important relationships that Russia now has in the Middle East, are they with Syria and Egypt?
Well, Egypt, it's developing. As you know, that they broke apart after 67 and when the Russia equipment failed, and then there was a big divergence. They also never had really good relationship with the Gulf because they were seen as communists and atheists, etc. They essentially had been blocked out of the Middle East, and now, by virtue of, some say, the mistakes by the West, some say by their own involvement and their huge military sales to Iran, to Syria, to other countries, and now perhaps to Egypt, which does say that they're not replacing the U.S. with Russia as the top ally, and there's all sorts of rumors, as I said, about the deal-making, arms sales, and other things that are coming up. So Russia today has one base outside of its territorial area, and that's at Latakia in Syria. So for them, that's a critical facility. Now they will perhaps have one at Alexandria in Egypt. remember, Russia historically has always feared Turkey, and it's, you know, sort of like the mouse and the elephant, but they've always feared and are apoplectic. They are very concerned about the developments in the region that might affect Chechnya and the Muslim areas under Russian control. And remember, Russians in Russia, Muslims make up a very significant part of the population, especially the peripheral areas. But even in the military, they are becoming a very significant part of the officer corps. Chechnya, they killed tens of thousands of Muslims there. They're always worried about an eruption. You have hundreds of Chechens fighting in Syria. And they are looking all the time for energy, because they want to control the flow of energy to Europe, which gives them leverage. They are looking, again, to break out of the isolation that followed, or the limitations that followed, the breakup of the former Soviet Union.
So the U.S. and Russia, which a few weeks ago you and I were talking about, you know, in their in the heated discussion, mostly about Syria, of course, and the arms sales and who they are supporting or not. Any difference over the last couple of months in the Obama-Putin relationship, in the U.S.-Russian relationship in general?
Oh, there have been a lot of points of tension. I don't see anything that's changed except the picture of the King of Saudi Arabia with Putin. The pictures of Lavrov now in Egypt shows that they are trying to fill a void. They're trying to take advantage of what they see as the West, and particularly the United States, diminished standing. And that's likely to continue.
Do you know if the, I'm being serious, do you know if the international community is looking at Obamacare and what's going on with our headlines over the last few weeks and reacting to the quote-unquote inefficiency of Washington, or it's basically irrelevant outside of this country?
Well, it was not, I don't know if the details of Obamacare particularly, but they should certainly watch the spectacle of the political infighting, as we do of other countries. We watch what happens in Iran or in Russia, and know that a leader is weaker or stronger, and whether he could take more advantage, less advantage of the situation. But it's not directly linked to Obamacare. I do think that they see the paralysis, the infighting, as an opportunity to exploit.
And also, I forgot to ask you about this last week. There was a report that the NSA, and this may not be any surprise to you or anybody else out there, the NSA spied in Israel. And Israel's been a target of spying by the UN, by the United States National Security Agency, according to a New York Times report, citing documents leaked by former NSA contractor Ed Snowden. According to the report, the U.S. and Israel collaborate on intelligence gathering with the Israel Signals Intelligence, or SIGINT, National Unit, a high-level intelligence unit receiving raw NSA eavesdropping material from the U.S. and providing raw material from its own surveillance in return. So we learned from that something that you've always told us, which is that there is a high-level, very cooperative effort on an intelligence basis between the United States and Israel. But we also learn that the NSA goes a step further and actually spies on Israel. In other words, they do their own checks and balances on a very important ally.
Remember that we were spying on all our allies,
right?
Are probably. I mean, we monitored 65 million calls in 1 month in Spain. I'm still trying to figure out what they could have learned, but the spying on Merkel's phone, or even maybe even her own cell phone, this was there was never a secret that the United States had agents in Israel. One of the points that was made is that Israel didn't go around arresting them. We should remember also this is the beginning of the 29th year of Jonathan Pollard's imprisonment.
Right.
And we should never forget it, and remember that he is languishing there.
And even if you agree with the that he deserved a punishment, as you've pointed out, now it's beyond that. It is a what do we call it? A human rights
That is a human rights issue.
A human rights issue. A 16-year-old stabbed an Israeli soldier to death on a bus in an attack apparently motivated by the jailing of his relatives in Israel, police said. The killing in the northern Israeli town of Afula follows a surge of violence in the nearby occupied West Bank, where 10 Palestinians have been shot dead by troops and 3 Israelis killed since peace talks resumed in July. Now, we know that there is no full-scale intifada, thank God, and we've discussed this, whether, in fact, we discussed this last week with Kerry's statement, if a threat of an intifada, if in fact, is even close to reality or not. But is there such an upsurge in violence, and what I guess we could refer to as political violence, like this attack and murder of an Israeli soldier on the bus this week?
Yes, I think there's a sharp increase. We've seen attacks both carried out or planned and some that were, thank God, caught. But there have been there's been a significant increase. The question was whether this was orchestrated. Were they individuals just who were incited? And it's one of the issues that is being raised, that especially after Secretary Kerry's visit to the region, where he was highly critical of Israel, and especially on the issue of settlements. But he did not go after Abbas for the incitement that continues from the Palestinian Authority, raising it all the time, you know, talking about construction on Al-Quds, Harabayat, and Temple Mount.
I don't even think you and I discussed the textbook article from the Times about a week ago.
Right. Well, the textbook is one, but by the way, the Hamas textbooks, and then their PA textbooks, UNRWA involvement in this, which is an issue we have discussed in the past,
right.
But it comes up all the time. But there are blatant appeals still honoring the martyrs. You know, when the terrorists who were released by Israel came home, they gave them these huge welcomes, and they get all the time they're in prison, they get a subsidy. You get it from the government, from the Palestinian Authority. 6% of their budget goes towards these allocations, and the bigger the crime and the longer your sentence, the more your family gets, the more money that you get. And some can say that, you know, it's fungible from American money. It's not American money being used for it, but when you put whatever money you put in, and we gave them $75 million more this month, they're not able to pay their electric bill to Israel, and the corruption continues, et cetera. So the question is, did they press them about this issue as much as they made these public statements? And I think the reference to a third intifada by the secretary, I'm sure it's something he regrets saying.
Oh, I hope he regrets it.
But also other comments where the onus is again being put on Israel, where Israel is sitting at the table prepared to negotiate, and the Palestinians, as we have seen in the past, are obfuscating. The team resigned, the negotiating team from the Palestinians resigned, again, something they've done regularly, so it hasn't caused much excitement. But they do it to grandstand and to make a political statement and then to be...
Yeah, come on. I heard this from Benjamin Netanyahu 30 years ago. Come on. Listen, quickly, now that he's officially foreign minister again, does Bibi have to worry about Avigdor Lieberman and public statements that he might make?
Well, actually, he's become the great conciliator in talking about how we have to... Israel and the United States have to work together.
Right.
Trying to tone down things. So maybe his absence is... made the heart grow
fonder.
He's had a
change of heart.
But just to answer that, I wanted to just go back.
Yeah.
That there's a second side to when you talk about Palestinian violence, and that's what's going on in Gaza, where Israel hit launchers because they were fired. They fired
mortars. Oh, of course, right.
And this was the anniversary of the war, a conflict last year.
Right.
And you saw thousands and thousands of Hamas security people take to the streets and demonstrations. But separately, Islamic Jihad had about 6,000 fighters in the streets, with some of them with anti-aircraft missiles for shoulder fired, the mobile rocket launchers, and other things that they put on display during the demonstration. And it's estimated that Iran still gives $50 million a year to Islamic Jihad. And while they diminish the amount of money to Hamas, we believe that they may that it continues. Even today.
All right. Way over time, and at least thank God we got to scratch the surface of some of these issues. But I must ask you, aside from the lesson that the future of the Jewish people is in the state of Israel, aside from that, what else do we learn this week regarding the anti-Semitic episodes at the Pine Bush School District?
That it's everywhere, and that you have to stand up to it, that you cannot turn a blind eye, that that the fact that it was kids doing it, if it in fact was just the kids doing it, they hear this at their homes, that it can't be dismissed as youthful excesses. The fact that the governor and others have come out strongly calling for the investigation, calling not allowing this to be swept under the rug, is very important. And I know for many people who may think that, you know, these things are marginal, they're not. They're symptoms, and we know that, you know, when there's smoke, there's fire, that we have to look beyond the surface at what this all means. And that's why the whole campaign of delegitimization, the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe and here too, I think in a different kind, and perhaps it's not, maybe not as blatant and as visible, but we certainly have enough anecdotal reporting, people have to learn one thing in particular. Report anti-Semitic incidents. Mm. Report it. The fact is that three-quarters, they say, of incidents in Europe and here do not get reported. People don't bother to take the time. It's a mistake. You don't have to wait till, God forbid, somebody is seriously hurt. The way you prevent it is by taking action and demanding follow-up and seeing what law enforcement and officials do. It's not the fact that you have haters in the society. It's how do the law enforcement, how do our authorities deal with it. And the lesson of this school, which easily could be overlooked or people could transfer their kids, it's got to be confronted and dealt with. And it doesn't matter the source of this. And when those who seek to divide us and those who seek to undermine us, whether from inside or outside, those who engage in these kind of practices, it's not acceptable if it's against Israel, because it's really against us as well.
Well said, and the future of the Jewish people is in the state of Israel. Hey, Malcolm, join me. We have a big JM in the AM Simcha. Join me in wishing you know Robert Katz very well. Join me in wishing a Mazel Tov. Jason Katz and Rebecca Fine got engaged last night.
Wow.
This is a second-generation JM in the AM first engagement. How do you like that? We're growing old here together.
Sounds like UN language is the first engagement of this. Okay.
I tried to make it as complicated.
He's a wonderful guy, and they deserve a lot of nachas.
There you go. So to Rebecca.
Everybody having.
Rebecca Fine and Jason Katz, Mazal Tov, and we are celebrating here at JM in the AM. Malcolm, thank you so much. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak again next week. Malcolm Holmline is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update Fridays at JM in the AM.